It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. John Munson in for Kate Archer-Kent today. Forensic science has become a major tool for the detection and prosecution of crimes. In recent years, however, problems have arisen as new research has challenged some expert testimony, and that's resulted in some overturned convictions. The city of Milwaukee will pay $7.5 million to a man in prison for more than two decades because of faulty bite mark evidence. The Wisconsin Innocence Project helped free Robert Lee Stinson a decade ago, drawing statewide attention. Here is the group's attorney speaking with reporters outside the prison that day.
It's been a long time coming for him. He's been in prison since I was 6 years old, which is just a really stunning thing for me to even consider.
This hour, this entire hour on the morning show, we discuss this case and more on wrongful convictions with a representative from the Wisconsin Innocence Project. What questions do you have about errors in our criminal justice system and how authorities respond to them? How have you reacted to wrongful convictions in Wisconsin or elsewhere? And how has that changed your view of criminal justice in our state? 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. You can also join us by sending an email to ideas@wpr.org. Stephen Wright is co-director of the Wisconsin Innocence Project and a clinical associate professor at the UW-Madison Law School. Stephen, thanks for joining us this morning.
Thank you for having me.
The city of Milwaukee will pay $7.5 million to Robert Lee Stinson because he was imprisoned for 24 years over faulty evidence. The Innocence Project helped free Stinson in 2009. Can you refresh our memory of this case? How did this wrongful conviction occur?
Sure. So Mr. Stinson was convicted largely based upon bite mark evidence. There wasn't a lot of evidence against him. They found what's called bite marks on the victim. And because Mr. Stinson had teeth that the experts claim were consistent with the bite mark, they were able to secure a conviction. It's important to note that there wasn't really any other evidence against Mr. Stinson. He just happened to, police just happened to believe that he was in the neighborhood, but there was no other type of physical evidence. And based upon the bite marks alone, police arrested him and prosecutors were able to secure the conviction.
Were bite marks commonly used as evidence in the 1980s when Stinson was convicted?
Yes, although the scientific community has largely disputed the validity of bite mark evidence actually continues to be used. Bite marks evidence is a part of an entire constellation of what we call junk science. That's science that comes in, is introduced to juries as sort of scientific fact that, in fact, has very little scientific validity. The overwhelming majority of bite mark evidence is actually very specious. The National Academies, which was established by Congress in the 19th century, looked at a wide array of forensic sciences and concluded that the overwhelming majority of them were actually not very good, and yet we use this type of science repeatedly to secure convictions in this country.
So why is that? Why do we continue to use disputed scientific evidence in criminal trials?
That's a good question. I think a large part of it is juries really like to have some type of scientific basis to substantiate their verdicts. I think that there is an expectation, especially among modern juries, that you need some type of science, some type of forensic science to tie a suspect to an actual crime. You know, the overwhelming majority of wrongful convictions often rely upon some type of faulty or incorrect evidence, whether it's faulty eyewitness evidence or faulty science. And so, you know, we're asking juries to make very, very difficult decisions based upon relatively small amounts of information in most cases. And so prosecutors are trying to do whatever they can to secure these convictions, even if it means reaching out to experts in these type of sciences that aren't real experts.
We're talking this hour about the lessons we're learning from wrongful convictions. Our guide, Stephen Wright, co-director of the Wisconsin Innocence Project. What questions do you have about errors in our criminal justice system and how authorities respond to them? How have you reacted to wrongful conviction in Wisconsin or elsewhere? And have they changed your view of criminal justice? Maybe you've been on a jury. How was scientific evidence presented in a case that maybe you listened to, and how did it influence your decision on whether or not a defendant was guilty or innocent? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. Email address is ideas@wpr.org. Okay, so aside from bite marks, let's talk about what other practices in forensic science that have come under greater criticism in recent decades due to wrongful convictions.
Yeah, I think perhaps the most famous in recent memory is the use of what forensic scientists called microscopic hair analysis. And basically, microscopic hair analysis involved finding a hair that was found on a victim or at a crime scene. Investigators would then take a hair from a suspect, and they would compare the hair found at the victim or the crime scene against the hair of the suspect. They would look at both of these hairs under a microscope and then try to reach some type of scientific conclusion. And oftentimes they would use language like it's a match, or they would assign some type of probability that they are 99% certain that the hairs belong to the same person. And this was a practice that was used throughout the country. In fact, the FBI, the Federal Bureau of Investigation, trained forensic teams across the country here in Wisconsin how to use microscopic hair analysis. But in the 90s and in the early 2000s, when we began to be able to use DNA and actually test these hairs, the FBI conducted a study, and they found that in the overwhelming majority of cases, the analysis provided by those experts, either at the state crime lab or by the FBI, they were just flat wrong. And perhaps heartbreakingly, this type of evidence was even used in capital cases where people had been executed. You know, this type of hair analysis now is largely discredited. We don't really use it anymore. In fact, the FBI, to their credit, wrote judges and prosecutors and governors around the state, letting them know that they had made these mistakes and encouraging the states to reinvestigate those claims where microscopic hair analysis may have helped contribute to a conviction.
We're talking about what we've learned from wrongful convictions in Wisconsin with Stephen Wright, co-director of the Wisconsin Innocence Project, and we're wondering what you think. Is our state doing enough, for example, to compensate people who are wrongfully convicted? Should lawmakers increase how much people are eligible to receive each year for each year they were falsely imprisoned? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. Email address is ideas@wpr.org. Our conversation with Stephen Wright is going to continue in just a moment. I'm John Munson. It's the morning show on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. We'd like to think that our criminal justice system works flawlessly, always putting the guilty in prison and seeing that the innocent go free, but that isn't always the case, and that's what we're talking about this hour on the morning show. Fred Saker served 6 years on rape charges that were overturned based on DNA evidence. He spoke at a public hearing last year in favor of boosting compensation rates for exonerees.
My 6 long years in prison and an additional year spent in county jail waiting for the 2 trials were filled with birthdays, holidays, celebrations of loved ones I could not attend. They were filled with moments I wanted to be a part of, but could not.
Stephen Wright is with us this morning to talk about wrongful convictions and what can be done to make sure the justice system works for everyone. He's co-director of the Wisconsin Innocence Project. Are you a lawyer, a police officer, or other person who works with criminal defendants? Have you participated in a jury? How do you feel about Wisconsin's criminal justice system? Are authorities doing enough to prevent wrongful convictions? 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. Ideas at WPR.org. You can also tweet us at WPR Mornings. What about this idea of compensating those who have been falsely imprisoned, Stephen Wright? What should we be doing there? What are we doing and what should we be doing there?
Sure. So Wisconsin has one of the worst compensation statutes in the nation. We provide people about $5,000 per year of incarceration up to a maximum of $25,000. So whether you served 5 years or 25 years, the most that you're going to get is $25,000. That the legislature or several legislators have sort of recognized the injustice of that and also seen that it is just inconsistent with compensation statutes around the country. There have been a couple proposals. The most recent proposal, I believe, offered up to $25,000 per year, up to $1 million. But the legislature has still failed to actually pass a compensation statute. I should also say one of the challenges that many exonerees face is the fundamental of transitioning back into society. Many exonerees don't get the luxury of many of the sort of social programs that other states provide, including counseling or education or guaranteed health care. So it's really a struggle for many exonerees, even beyond the financial hardship, even beyond being deprived of your liberty and missing out on opportunities with your family.
In addition to errors in science, Innocence Projects around the country often point to eyewitness mistakes as a leading cause of wrongful convictions. Is that also true in Wisconsin?
That is true in Wisconsin. And nationally and by far, eyewitness error is the leading cause of wrongful conviction. I think it's present in maybe 3 out of 4, 3 out of 5 of all wrongful convictions. It's particularly prevalent in cross-racial identifications. You know, I think people don't fully appreciate how difficult difficult it is to actually see the perpetrator of a crime during sort of the passion of the moment. I mean, if you think about it, if you're being attacked or you're being robbed and someone's got a gun in your face, you're probably not paying attention very much to the person's face. You're probably paying attention to the gun. That's to say nothing of the actual stress and psychological pressures that come with that moment. Pressures that scientists tell us can actually impact the coding, the way that your mind actually stores the memory of what's happening. So eyewitness identification, in many cases, it's individuals who made a sincere mistake, who picked the wrong person out of a lineup. Sometimes it's an innocent mistake. Sometimes it's a function of perhaps police making a suggestive lineup. But these contribute to false eyewitness identifications or erroneous eyewitness identifications, which in turn leads to a significant number of all wrongful convictions.
The nation's Innocence Project movement gained momentum in the early 1990s with advances in DNA technology. How did you get involved in this type of work?
So I was very fortunate. The Wisconsin Innocence Project has been a leader nationally in the Innocence movement. And one of the indications of our success is that we've received a number of federal grants from the United States Department of Justice. The United States Department of Justice, supported by funding provided by bipartisan legislation offers grants to states and law schools and innocence projects around the country to conduct DNA and to conduct DNA testings. So we were very fortunate about 5-6 years ago to receive a grant from the United States Department of Justice that funded a position, an attorney, to investigate DNA-based claims of wrongful convictions, and I was fortunate enough to be selected, and I've been around the project ever since.
Okay, so where, how does Wisconsin's Innocence Project compare to what's going on in other states?
Sure. So the Wisconsin Innocence Project, like many programs around the country, is based in a law school. We are primarily a teaching institution. My co-director, Carrie Sperling, and I train between 12 and 18 students. And the two of us and our students, we investigate and litigate claims of innocence from around the country. People who are incarcerated, they write us or their family write us, and they say, listen, I'm doing a significant amount of time, 5, 10, 20 years, for a crime that I didn't commit. And we review those applications, and if we think there might be something to it, the students and I and Carrie, we look into them. We re-interview witnesses. We record transcripts. We do testing of DNA.
We're talking about wrongful convictions this hour with Stephen Wright, co-director of the Wisconsin Innocence Project. Wondering what you think about all of this. Are you a lawyer, police officer, someone else who works with criminal defendants? Have you participated in a jury? How do you feel about Wisconsin's criminal justice system? And do you think authorities are doing enough to prevent wrongful convictions? Give us a call at 800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. So at any given time, how many cases are you working with, Stephen? What kind of caseload can you handle?
Yeah, that's a good question. Right now, we train about 13 students, and collectively, we probably have in the neighborhood of 30 to 35 cases that we're looking at.
And does the project also help exonerees seek compensation from the state or from law enforcement after they're freed?
Yeah, so we've been very fortunate. We partner with an organization called After Innocence, which is housed in San Francisco. And After Innocence does a wonderful job of helping bring together resources and exonerees. And so they help sort of fill in that gap where the state government is lacking.
Let's take a call. Rich is with us in Rhinelander this morning. Rich, good morning.
Well, I hope this is an appropriate, good morning. I hope this is an appropriate question. But I'm wondering your guest's opinion, if there is a socioeconomic component to this, and I mean to include in the question not just the typical socioeconomic status of what we call minorities in our state, that is people of color who generally, not always, but generally have lower income levels, but also poor whites. It seems to me that our public defender standards in the state also need a look-see about what a lawyer gets in terms of remuneration for.
Okay. Rich, we get it. I want to get Stephen's answer before the news. What about it? Is there a socioeconomic or racial element to wrongful convictions?
Yes, that's true both nationally and here in Wisconsin. And it's not only an appropriate question; it's a very important question. African Americans, in particular, make up a disproportionate number of wrongful convictions. Depending upon what study you look at, African American men, in particular, make up anywhere from 50% to 65% of all wrongful convictions. Compare that, obviously, with the proportion of African American men in society. You can see that that obviously it's a huge problem.
What about the status of public defenders in Wisconsin? There's been a lot of talk about the shortage of public defenders and about a lack of compensation. Does this contribute to the kind of defense that someone who doesn't have the money to pay for their own attorney and investigators, does this affect their how they're treated at trial?
It is. And in many ways, this ties back to the earlier discussion about faulty sciences. It's not only important that your lawyer have time to deal with your case and that your lawyer be well compensated, but you've got to also keep in mind if the state puts forth an expert, the defense too should have the opportunity to have an expert, and experts aren't cheap. So defendants not only have to pay for the lawyer, they have to pay for sometimes an investigator, but they've got to pay for the expert to be able to refute the state's evidence. And obviously experts, you know, people with doctorates, scientific experts, they don't come cheap.
Okay. Our conversation with Stephen Wright, co-director of the Wisconsin Innocence Project, continues after the news. What do you think about how criminal justice works in Wisconsin? How have you reacted to news of wrongful convictions? Share your thoughts and questions at 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. I'm John Munson. This is The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson in for Kate Archer Kent. In recent years, the Netflix series Making a Murderer has brought global attention to Wisconsin by chronicling the 2007 convictions of Stephen Avery and Brendan Dassey for the gruesome murder of photographer Teresa Halbach. Many viewers were disturbed to watch how investigators pressed Dassey for a confession since he was a minor at the time.
I'm your friend right now, but I gotta believe in you. And if I don't believe in you, I can't go to bat for you. Okay, you're nodding. Tell us what happened.
Your mom said you'd be honest with us.
We're talking about criminal justice issues in Wisconsin this hour on The Morning Show, and we'd like to hear from you. What questions do you have about errors in our criminal justice system and how authorities respond to them? 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. Stephen Wright is co-director of the Wisconsin Innocence Project and a clinical associate professor at the UW-Madison Law School. Stephen, how about the portrayal of criminal justice in popular media? And one of the reasons we have had such an emphasis in science, it seems, is that it we've got a whole raft of what are called police procedurals on television and in documentaries and so forth. We're just used to seeing in the last act criminals convicted based on some minute particle of something or other discovered at a crime scene and investigated by scientists. How does that affect how juries take a look at scientific evidence and evaluate it in court?
That's a good question. I think part of that question is that juries are often looking for more objective pieces of information. Juries assume that scientists come in and that they don't have a bias, and they're actually just looking at a piece of evidence from a scientific perspective and reaching conclusions. But I agree it's a part of a larger discussion that does include why or why not we believe police officers. Shady police officer work or police misconduct is a leading cause of wrongful convictions. We've seen actually hundreds of exonerations based upon almost exclusively upon bad police conduct. The most perhaps prominent example recently was the Baltimore Gun Task Force, in which the FBI and the U.S. Department of Justice Civil Rights Division actually secured prosecutions against police officers who were framing individuals, were planting drugs, were stealing money, were really just terrorizing a community. Now, I should note that a lot of the exonerations that have been that have been secured based upon police misconduct, they're overwhelmingly in gun and drug cases. We obviously do see them in some of the more serious crimes, the sexual assaults and murders. But by and large, police misconduct has contributed to a wave of exonerations of people who were convicted of drug offenses or gun offenses, who really didn't commit any crime and whose only crime was living in a poor community that was terrorized by corrupt cops.
Let's take a call here. Joe is with us in Eau Claire. Joe, good morning. Thanks for joining us on the morning show today.
Yeah, thanks. I've got a question about, is anybody addressing or first tracking these injustices? Is there a pattern? And then is there anybody that is trying to implement changes so that they're not repeated, like all the way from the police level all the way up to prosecution and judge?
Okay. Joe, thanks so much for the call. What about it, Stephen? Are we tracking these, and what are we doing to see that that we get fewer of these cases?
Yeah, Joe, that's a great question. So the University of Michigan has what's called a National Registry of Exonerations, and they're keeping track. And they not only keep track of a lot of very good stories and the narratives of those individuals who have been exonerated, they're telling us why those individuals have been exonerated and what evidence contributed to the wrongful conviction and what evidence was used to actually exonerate the person. I can say that one of the good things that has come about of a society being more aware that there are wrongful convictions is that there are a great number of academics who actively study, research, and propose policy solutions. In addition, the Innocence Project based in New York works with local innocence projects like the Wisconsin Innocence Project to come up with policy solutions to help prevent wrongful convictions.
How does the Innocence Project decide which cases to pursue?
Yeah, so we have a process. It begins with an application. Someone who is incarcerated or a family member of someone who's incarcerated, they write us. And the person fills out a form, and they share as much information as they possibly can. It probably doesn't surprise you that someone who is wrongfully convicted probably actually doesn't know who actually committed the crime. All they know is that they didn't do it. So the students and I review applications, and it varies, but somewhere in the neighborhood of anywhere between 3 and maybe 10 applications we receive each week. And the students and I, we try to get as much information about each applicant as we can. If public records are available, court opinions, newspaper articles, as well as any information that the applicant wishes to share. Then the students and I normally call the applicant or visit the applicant and we do an interview. And if we think that there's something there, then we try to take their case. Obviously, we're limited by both time and resources and money, but we try to help as many people as we can.
We had a caller who couldn't stay with us, Dan from Drummond, who wanted to know how to get in touch with your group if someone thinks they've been wrongfully convicted.
Sure. So our applications are available in most prisons around the state. If all one needs to do is visit the prison library and they can get an application. Likewise, if someone wants to write us, they can get our application that way. Our application is also available online. And I should say that our application is available both in English and in Spanish.
And what are the red flags that you're looking for a possible wrongful conviction when you're investigating these, when you're checking on these cases?
Sure. So we're primarily looking for a couple things. One of them is whether there's a presence of the many factors that we've been discussing today, whether there's an allegation of false eyewitness identification, whether there's the possibility of faulty signs being used, whether there's a possibility of police misconduct. We're always on the lookout for those red flags. In addition, when we're screening, we're really asking, is there a possibility to find something new? Is there a possibility that perhaps there is a rape kit that hasn't been tested? Is there a possibility that there was a witness who may have seen something who didn't feel comfortable coming forth? We even get cases occasionally from people who have been jailhouse informants, who have been snitches, who write us and say, you know, I did something very bad a few years ago. I really want to clear my conscience. It's very important that you understand that I provided false testimony, and that can also be a basis by which we accept an application.
What do you hope your law students take away from working for the Innocence Project?
So primarily, we're hoping to teach them that the criminal justice system is imperfect. And one of the ways that they do that is they actually get to immerse themselves in a full case. Our students deal with almost every single aspect of the case, from picking which cases we actually take to investigating them. Our students regularly visit the maximum security prisons around the state to interview clients and to potentially interview witnesses. They go to court. They talk to judges. So, you know, we really hope that they get a personalized, if not a transformative, understanding of the way the criminal justice system works in Wisconsin, both the good things that the state does and the things where the state needs to do a little bit better.
We're talking about miscarriages of justice this hour with Stephen Wright, co-director of the Wisconsin Innocence Project. How have you reacted to wrongful conviction cases in the news? Have they changed your view of the criminal justice system or of police officers, lawyers, prosecutors? How do you feel about all of this? 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. Email us ideas@wpr.org. Stephen, has working on these wrongful conviction cases revealed to you at least any problems in the system here in Wisconsin? Where do you see the systemic flaws in our state?
I think there are there's certain sort of choke points that happen at the system. What I guess I've been a little bit surprised is the unwillingness sometimes of some prosecutors in some communities to revisit convictions, even when there are convictions based upon very flimsy evidence. And the Wisconsin Innocence Project has sought, say, to do DNA testing. We sometimes run into opposition. We sometimes have to have litigated against local prosecutors and, in some cases, the Wisconsin Department of Justice, who refuse to test a rape kit that's been sitting in the locker that could determinatively not only tell us whether somebody is innocent, but has the potential to tell us who really committed the crime. That, I think, has been among the more surprising aspects of this job.
Where does that resistance come from?
I don't know, to be perfectly honest. I think a large part of it is an unwillingness to sort of potentially destabilize a conviction. I think prosecutors sometimes are very skeptical of all claims brought by persons in prison. There's a certain amount of mistrust. And I think there's perhaps a little bit of fear that the possibility that the DNA might come back and suggest that there's somebody else. I think that's sometimes very difficult for some members of the legal community to handle.
Stephen Wright is co-director of the Wisconsin Innocence Project. Our conversation about the criminal justice system in Wisconsin will continue in just a moment, but we'd like to hear from you this morning. You can join our discussion about criminal justice in Wisconsin at 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. Maybe you're a member of the law enforcement community. We'd like to get your perspective on this as well, 800-642-1234. I'm John Munson. It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. We're talking with Stephen Wright, co-director of the Wisconsin Innocence Project, about how our criminal justice system in Wisconsin works and doesn't work. How do you react when you hear about an overturned conviction? 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. Matt from Appleton couldn't stay with us, Stephen, but he wanted to share that the conversation reminded him of the classic film Mr. Smith Goes to Washington and a scene where two experts are arguing whether he was guilty of fraud over handwriting. Is handwriting another type of evidence that's come under question in recent years?
It has. The problem with handwriting analysis, which is very similar to many other faulty sciences is that it's not scientifically verifiable. There's no objective scientific test to determine whether handwriting analysis is actually valid. It's not in that same league as, say, DNA evidence. And so handwriting analysis, bite mark evidence, hair analysis, one of the advantages of modern forensic sciences is that we do have good sciences like DNA, but those other sciences, they're just not even close to being in the same league.
The Wisconsin Innocence Project averages about one exoneration per year, which is a tiny fraction of the number of new convictions every year. How do you respond to the idea that our criminal justice system is okay because exonerations are so rare?
I think that's probably the wrong way of looking at it. Our system is based upon the idea of the state having the burden of proving innocence beyond a reasonable doubt. And when we know that in Wisconsin, say, we have an exoneration every year, we know that's the tip of the iceberg. And so we know that the system is failing. I also think perhaps that perspective might change when you actually meet the exonerees, when you meet someone who lost 20 years of their life like Mr. Stinson, when you meet someone who whose life was forever changed and destabilized. Even once people get out, even once their names have sort of been cleared, there is still not only the stigma, but there's a lot of psychological pressure that comes with those exonerations. And so, we all should work very hard towards to ensuring that wrongful convictions are something that just don't happen in our system.
How often does the Innocence Project receive suggestions for cases to review from within law enforcement?
Occasionally. I would say we probably get one or two cases recommended to us a year.
We're talking about wrongful convictions this hour with Stephen Wright, co-director of the Wisconsin Innocence Project. Maybe you're an attorney or a police officer or someone else who works with criminal defendants. Maybe you've participated in a jury. How do you feel about the way Wisconsin's criminal justice system works? And do you think authorities are doing enough to prevent wrongful convictions? Give us a call at 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or email us. The address is ideas@wpr.org. There's been a nationwide push in recent years to get thousands of years-old rape kits tested for DNA, and you referenced DNA testing earlier, Stephen. What do you think about Wisconsin's response to untested rape kits?
I think it's a mixed bag. Obviously, testing rape kits is a good way of solving unsolved crimes. It's a good way of bringing peace of mind perhaps to victims that their case was fully investigated and law enforcement did everything that they could to find out the perpetrator of a crime. I can say that we've been a little bit disappointed that the Department of Justice is not willing to go back and test some of the rape kits in cases in which a conviction was secured. I understand the Wisconsin Department of Justice received federal funding to test the backlog of rape kits, and they made the decision to, I believe, just do a random sample, and we don't know very much about that, of rape kits in cases where a conviction had already been secured. My hope would be that, in part, to bring peace of mind to victims and to both ensure the integrity of the criminal justice system and convictions, that they would be at least willing to look at testing some of those kits in cases that already had convictions.
Todd from La Crosse was a caller who couldn't stay with us, but he wanted to know, how reliable is DNA evidence?
So DNA evidence has been transformative in helping police and the criminal justice system both exonerate individuals who have been wrongfully convicted and identify those who have been who have committed crimes. It's no forensic science is ever going to be 100%, but one of the, you know, there's still considerable debate when DNA is presented about, you know, the statistics that say, you know, is there one in, you know, a billion match or one in a billion possibility of a match, sometimes about statistics and how DNA is collected, and especially when there are things called mixed samples, which means there's DNA from two or more perpetrators or two or more people, I guess I should say, there's still considerable controversy. But on the whole, you know, DNA has sort of transformed criminal justice investigations, and obviously has opened up a whole new era of investigating wrongful convictions.
Are any police agencies or prosecutors conducting their own reviews for errors in past cases?
So many states have established, or many prosecutors around the country have established, what's called convictions integrity units. And especially in the past 5 or 6 years around the country, prosecutors going back and looking at their own suspect in convictions has increased the number of identification of wrongful convictions. We don't really have that tradition here in Wisconsin. Milwaukee had a criminal had a conviction integrity unit. It did not find. I don't believe it found any convictions that gave them pause, or at least that publicly gave them pause, where they went back and reinvestigated. You know, we're hoping to change that here in Wisconsin.
Yeah, I mean, most of us have been called to have gotten a notice to report for jury duty at some point. And I guess I'm wondering, when there are competing scientific claims, the prosecutor has an expert, the defense has an expert, as a juror, how does one look at this evidence, and should we be doing more to teach jurors how to analyze the evidence that's in front of them?
I think that's a great question. I think that goes to a larger question about how we go about discussing science and technology in society. I'm often surprised when I'm reviewing transcripts, or even when I occasionally talk to jurors. Most jurors just don't have a scientific background, and so we're asking them to make scientific conclusions or making judgments based upon experts. And oftentimes studies show sometimes jurors will trust an expert for reasons that have nothing to do with what the expert is saying, everything from, you know, what the experts are wearing to what an expert may look like. And so we need to do more, I think, in general about educating our society generally about science and the limitations of science. And yes, judges and prosecutors and defense attorneys could do a much better job at educating jurors about the limits of science.
And are you working on any cases that you can tell us about that you'll be filing soon?
So we have an upcoming case in Milwaukee that deals with one of the leading wrongful convictions, which is jailhouse snitches. One of our clients, LaShawn Jackson, was convicted of a crime when he was 16 or 17, a homicide in a gang-related shooting that we believe he didn't commit. The evidence against him largely relied upon a jailhouse informant. He trusted someone that he shouldn't have trusted in jail and sharing his police file. That person in turn went to prosecutors and claimed that LaShawn confessed to the crime, when in fact that person just merely read the material that was in LaShawn's discovery. That person thankfully has come forward, has admitted that he did not tell the truth, and he's recanted.
Where can we learn more about the Wisconsin Innocence Project?
Sure. So you can visit the University of Wisconsin Law School website, or you can just Google us, Wisconsin Innocence Project, online.
Thank you, Stephen, so much for joining us this morning. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you for having me.
Stephen Wright is co-director of the Wisconsin Innocence Project and a clinical associate professor at the UW-Madison Law School. This is The Morning Show. I'm John Munson on the Ideas Network.